on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Oh my God, I can't believe it.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Welcome to another edition of
Happiness to be found even in the darkest of times.
That system probably contains a new data encryption algorithm. You'll never get in there.
Welcome to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Rose, the show that talks all things mental health, emotional well-being, and what we can do to make us that little bit happier. Now, my guest today grew up on the South Coast. After leaving school at 16, he pursued a career in music, joining a band and touring the UK, with the highlight being a performance at Glastonbury Festival, no less. After the birth of his first son, my guest found his passion for writing and went on to author 9 children's picture books. His debut, The Fearsome Beastie, won the People's Book Prize 2012, The Heart of Hwick Children's Book Award in 2013, The Busy Baby Gold Award, and the US Forward National Literary Award. Many of his other titles have also gone on to be shortlisted for other prestigious awards. It was in March this year my guest released his first novel for adults, 152 Days, written in the first person, 152 Days is a semi-autobiographical piece about a boy whose mother is terminally ill. Its emotive writing takes you on a journey of solitude, isolation, attraction, and frustration. Steeped in developmental angst, it's an incredible journey through a turbulent time and experience. And in my words, an absolute masterpiece. Not only is my guest an award-winning writer, but he co-hosts and produces the award-nominated Blank podcast. I am delighted to welcome to the show, if you haven't guessed already, it's Mr. Giles Paley Phillips. Giles, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm very flattered by that introduction.
Well, you know, I had so much and I thought, you know what, I will have to trim it because it's really, there's so much you've done. And as I say, it is such an honour to have you on a show. I know we spoke about this off air, but I'm genuinely excited, like a giddy schoolboy excited to have you on the show.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, listen, we must, I mean, many of my guests I have on, I sort of open this show up and say, you know, introduce yourself to the listeners and tell us a little bit about yourself. And really, I don't feel we need to be doing that with your good self because, you are someone that in the world of literature and children's books and social media as well, we might add, are very much a heavyweight, if you will, in that world. Kick things off with 152 days.
Of course, yeah.
Would you mind, for those that haven't perhaps read it, share a little bit about the book and the process of bringing that masterpiece together?
Well, it's very kind of you to call it a masterpiece. Never heard it being described as that. That's very kind of you. Well, it was a long process, really. I think we'll have to go back quite a long way, really, to sort of the days just after the band I was in split up. I know you sort of alluded to the fact that I've been in bands and stuff, and a big band I was in sort of in the, I guess, the early noughties. We were kind of really close to kind of getting a big record deal, and we were quite close to sort of making it, I guess is what everyone calls it, doesn't they, when you've made it. The band split up. I think we'd done a lot of tours and stuff, and I think it just all got a bit much for us all, really, I think, in hindsight. And so I think after that, I was sort of looking and struggling to sort of be still creative. I think music had sort of, I was like feeling slightly bruised with music and feeling that I wanted to do something different. And I was always into writing lyrics and stuff. Obviously, used to write quite a lot of lyrics in the band. And so I think I decided I wanted to put something together. I'd written a song called Carpi, which was about, so Carpi's the, my mum's maiden name was Carpenter. So she sort of, her nickname was Carpi. And so we'd written this, I'd written this song years before, and it was about her, and it was about kind of pretty much the sort of mourning that she'd passed away, sort of elements of that and the feelings around that. And so I decided I wanted to put together a kind of booklet of lyrics and poems that I'd kind of written on the same subject. And I was just going to kind of self-release it, and then the proceeds go to leukemia research. My mum passed away from leukemia when I was six. So I think it was just a kind of like little passion project, a little, you know, a little thing I could do, something for charity. And it was this little outlet for me to put together some of these lyrics that I'd already written about her and stuff. And so to cut a long story short, I did that, and then we, you know, raised £500 or £600. And then I kind of started, it was sort of the nugget of maybe developing this into something else, a story, you know, written in poetry, in verse. And at the time, I think I just thought this is probably a stupid thing to do because no one's going to want to read this. You know, I mean, I've always been into poetry, but it always feels a slightly kind of, what's the word? It's not necessarily something commercial. Not that I wanted it to be commercial, and an art should never be that in your mind. It should always be the creative process is this thing. But I just thought, what if I do this, is anyone going to want to read it, you know? And so I started just doing it for myself, really, writing a story, but in verse, in poetry, which had this sort of linear thread through it, of a story. And I wanted it to be biographical to an extent and have lots of elements of my own experiences. But at the same time, I wanted it to have that freedom that I could go with it in different directions. So it wasn't sort of restricted to just being about my story. It meant I could put in slightly different elements to it. And I mean, the story is basically biographical to an extent. The protagonist in it is older than I was when my mum passed away. But it is certainly my feelings and angst around that time during my teen years. And so, yeah, so anyway, I started writing this book. And eventually, a few years later, after I'd kind of started having a few bits of works published, and eventually got myself an agent, I sort of sent it to her in a very rough sort of first draft. And she said, oh, I really like, you know, she really sort of fell in love with it straight away, which was a good sign. But then she sort of warned me that it would be very, very difficult to find a publishing deal for it. But just because some of the sort of reasons I thought of in the first place was that it was very niche, very, very personal. And actually, how many people would actually want to read this, you know? So, but that, you know, they didn't dissuade me. I carried on, you know, putting it together. And yeah, that's kind of how it came about, I guess, in the first place.
Well, I'm pleased that you, I'm pleased that you pushed forward with it. And I suppose disappointing to hear that it was sort of seen as niche, you know, in those initial conversations, because I think for me, and for those that haven't read it, I do urge you to go out and buy it and download it and in digital form or whatever suits your reading requirements, because the it's laced with so much emotion. And the journey itself, I mean, there are parts and pieces in there that pack such a punch. And that's perhaps, you know, coming from the world of psychology and the interest of the narrative behind almost the words that people are speaking is always going to be of great interest to me. But I think that the way that it carries throughout the book, I just think it's amazing. I think that the way that you capture some of those moments is truly incredible. Honestly, absolutely incredible. From, you know, there's the ones of looking down or something, or storm and the noise in your head, and it just blew me away. Absolutely blew me away.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very, very kind. I'm not very good. I'm trying harder to take compliments on board. It's very hard when people say nice things about you. I'm glad that it resonated with you in that way. And it's one of those things where I think I knew in my heart that it would resonate with people. I think, you know, I know other people that have been through similar circumstances to me. They've lost people close to them. They're grieving. And I knew that I had to speak to them and I had to speak to myself. I mean, I think the bulk of the work on it, I probably did at a time where I nearly needed to do it. I was probably going through a reflective period of my life, and it was very cathartic putting it together. You know, it was very cathartic delving into those memories. Like I say, some of it isn't, you know, is certainly fictional, or my idea of what those kind of moments would be like. But you know, bits, the sections of it where I was sleeping on the beach, I did that in my late teens. I went and slept on the beach. I was semi-homeless for a while. I was in between places and I slept on the beach, and there was times like that where, you know, where I did reflect on those feelings. And loss was, you know, I can imagine for anybody that's who's without somewhere safe to call home, that, you know, loss is paramount to them, of all different types of loss, you know. So having those feelings, and I just wanted to get those things across, and hopefully that is the case. So yeah, for me it was vital in a way for me to be able to write that book, and it helped me no end writing it. It's, you know, it's made me much more at peace with you know, about 10 years of my life, which was very difficult.
Well, interestingly, I was going to ask that, you know, you use that phrase there, cathartic process. And you know, when speaking to writers in the past and people have, you know, shared that lived experience, revisiting some of those emotions and those periods or times in our life is cathartic, can be quite challenging sometimes. Mm. Over the journey of pulling that piece together, was it reasonably stable, or was it a roller coaster? Was it really challenging at times, some parts of the writing?
Yeah, definitely challenging. I mean, there were times where I had to just stop and put it aside and then come back to it months later. I mean, I would take breaks for a few months sometimes, just because I wasn't in the right headspace for it, whatever. But each time I came back, you know, you kind of have, I think any type of writing, actually, if you have breaks from it, even if it's for a few hours or a day or, you know, whatever it might be, I think you come back with renewed energy and renewed, you know, you have it, new eyes on it. And I think it's always a really good, I mean, I do say to people that write, if they're struggling, just leave it and come back to it again. But yeah, I think, yeah, certainly it wasn't easy. I had to I was really kind of delving into some forgotten memories and some forgotten feelings, more than the memories, the feelings, and actually trying to sort of get into those spaces within. And you know, you go back there, and so it's going to affect your day to day when you're, you know, whatever, even if you're in a good place, it's going to put you back in a place where you weren't so good. So yeah, I think it was important to have breaks from it, just self-preservation more than anything, really.
Well, it is. It certainly comes through in the book itself. And what was magical was how you, you know, the show was never set up to be a book review, but it's really important that I share my how I found reading it, because I think what struck me was how you were able to share very explicitly and expertly the observations both of the character in the story, the boy. His observations of the external world, but equally his experience of his internal world as well. So so the emotion that he was experiencing going through this transition, this developmental transition, and as we said before, the angst that goes with these trying times, and then the loss of a parent as well. And that's the bit that really struck me, was the accurate representation of how someone going through crisis and a difficult experience can still be torn between their internal experience and requirements and pleasures and drivers against actually what's going on in the world. And there's that wonderful part around I think is it Bad, where it's the conflict between thinking of Freya, who's the physiotherapist, and mum and mum's illness, and that push me pull me, and the desires that come with from all of us, really. I just think it was absolutely crazy how accurate and clever the writing was in that.
Oh, well, that's very, very kind. Yeah, I think it was important to, I think, you know, going through my own teen life, you have these, you know, you have this baggage, you have this weight of, you know, grief and loss. I mean, my teenage life wasn't easy either. My dad was an alcoholic. So he was distant and not really very parental. And we lived, you know, the scenes of the flat are real in the book. I mean, we lived in a one bedroom flat. It was me and my dad sharing a room, and my nan slept on the sofa. So it was a very, so weird kind of setup. My dad had financial difficulties, so we ended up, we probably shouldn't have lived there either. I think it was a residential property. So I think it was my nan's flat, sort of a granny flat kind of thing that she'd got sort of cancelled. We probably weren't supposed to live there. I remember them sort of saying, "You've got to be quiet when you come in the evenings and stuff." So no one knows we're there. So it's kind of a really random existence for quite a chunk of my teenage life. And people didn't really know, you know, people didn't know. And so we're sort of delving into those points, you know. But at the same time, you've got those same, like we say, like those things where I'm going to school, I want to wear the right clothes. I don't want to, you know, we didn't have, like I said, I think we had to go to the laundrette to like wash the clothes often, because we didn't have a proper washer dryer at home. So, you know, sometimes my clothes weren't particularly nice. You know, I had to use some of my dad's old shirts and stuff like that. And they were a bit you know, so I would go to school with, you know, with dirty clothes and stuff sometimes. And you think, particularly when you're a teenager, those things are they're so on the surface, aren't they? And you're worrying about those sort of things, the way you look, the way you appear, the way you sound, all those things. And so you're kind of worrying about those things as well as all this other stuff that's churning around inside you. So going back there was difficult, for sure. But I'm glad that, you know, you like so many have been able to pick up on that and see something of their own kind of teenage years. I think, I mean, it's just so hard, those times, aren't they? It's such a time of our lives in some respects.
Yeah, it is such a turbulent period. And I think it's a period that, you know, we come out the other side, and it's almost like for many women, childbirth, in the sense that, you know, once it's gone, then, you know, they're happy to have more children, as it were, but the adolescent period, we become blinded by it thereafter, that we don't want to go back and revisit it. But it is you know, I think the reach is, you know, it's not the specifics of parental loss that I think the book strikes. I think that it can resonate, as you say, with so many different people because of the way that the story unfolds, and as I say, the contrast and friction that's created between the development and that development of self and that sense of self-worth and who we are, and beginning to refine an understanding as we go through those tricky years. Giles, if I may, obviously you said we touched on the process of writing 152 Days, and you said that it was cathartic and it was right for that period of time. Therapeutically speaking, often, you know, I'll speak with individuals I'm working with or guests that I've had on the show, and we've spoken about the importance of relationship and how being able to exercise some of those heavy emotions that we've carried for a long period of time, we're able to do that when there is a positive grounding, when there's a foundation for us to sort of entertain some of that challenging as well. Now, I know obviously you shared on social media as well, your lovely wife, your two children as well. Mm. Was that an important part of producing this piece now at this time in your life?
Oh, huge, huge. I never would have been able to write this book if I hadn't been with Michelle, my wife, and having the kids. I don't think, I think it was really important that I had that, you know, had them to come back to after after moments of being in the thick of writing, and like I say, delving into those difficult emotions. So that, yeah, they played a vital part in keeping me grounded, keeping me safe, actually. Like I say, I wrote this, I mean, I've been with my wife now for 20 years. I mean, we've been married for 18. So, you know, she's been there through the whole process, you know, and it's great, you know, we relate well. My wife and I, she lost her dad when she was very young as well. So she knows how it works. She's been through those times. So she could really relate to it as well. And it was great to have that sounding board as well, just to be able to say, look, do you think, you know, have I gone too far here? Is this too, you know, all those kind of things. And she was able to give me advice and support. And then obviously kids are a great distraction, aren't they? Especially young children, you come out of and to be fair, we've always been very honest with our children about both of our circumstances. You know, they often wondered why they haven't got grandparents on one side of the family and why they've only got one grandparent on the other, you know. So we've always been very honest about loss with them from an early age, in fact. So they've always been able to relate to it to a certain extent as well. But at the same time, they're into their own things and they just want to tell you about Minecraft and as you might know, Xboxes and Switch, the Nintendo Switches and whatever, you know. So whatever they're into, or Lego, you know, so you got that distraction as well. So I think, yeah, having that safe base at home was really, really, really important. And again, in those times where I had to take breaks from it, from the process, they were amazing to be able to help me through those moments, you know, when times were difficult. So yeah, I think you're totally right in what you say. I think for me, it was vital to have them in the background, definitely.
Mm. And loss, well, if we look theoretically speaking, so, or from a clinical perspective, loss, there's one theory that suggests that as human beings, we never actually really overcome loss of someone that's important to us, because we don't possess the infrastructure to do so. It says that we're raised on this rupture and repair principle. So it's several weeks, sometimes creeping into months, before an infant will recognize that it's separate from the mother. And neuroscientists would say that's the dawn of consciousness in ourselves as human beings. And but it's also at that point that the infant recognizes the vulnerability, the state of fragility that it's in. And so it quickly begins to manipulate the environment to form connection again. So it recognizes the rupture and then forms a repair. And this process becomes cyclical. It keeps repeating itself. So parent goes out of sight. So existence theory, the infant doesn't realize that the person's still existing. So again, coos, cries, manipulates the environment. Parent comes in, scoops them up, hugs them, and there's the repair again. We're dropped at school, left there, rupture. Parents come at the end of the day, there's a repair, and on it goes. And so theoretically, it said that we don't actually ever, you know, overcome it. The world just swallows us up and we just keep moving. Rather long-windedly, I apologize, but the question really is that process of producing this piece, the loss that you experienced before, or the, it's not used loss as the emotion, but the emotions that you experienced before, did they alter at all? Or where do you sit with that loss now? And what does it feel like?
Well, I've always described to others about grief being a journey which kind of never ends. And so I'm just in a different part of that journey at the moment. I think there'll be other times, I'm sure, to come where the journey will get difficult again. You know, I think it's sort of, it's hills and valleys. And at the moment, I guess I'm just on a straight road and the path is fairly untamed. It's not too bad. It's kind of, there aren't too many thickets or, I'm going off into forestry kind of metaphors here.
It's okay.
but what I mean is, what I'm trying to say is that, yeah, at the moment the path is pretty steady and it's fine. But I think there have been difficult valleys to and the hills to maneuver through, and there will be more to come. And I think it's, yeah, like I say, I think it's a journey that never really comes to an end, but there are moments in it that are better than others. That's always how I've kind of seen it, really. Even from a young age, I've kind of thought about it being like that, that, you know, there are good days and bad days. I mean, I often put up pictures of my parents, and I always sort of put this little phrase with it. It says, like, some days you don't think about them and other days you think about them the most. And, you know, there are days where you don't even kind of remember. Like, you know, I mean, there are probably days where I just don't even give it a second thought. And then there are days where you're deep in it and it's all that's really there. So, yeah, I agree that I think you don't, I mean, I can't see you ever fully recover, but I think you obviously recover to an extent where you can function. You recover to an extent where you can continue to love and live your life. But I think, like I say, it's a journey that we're constantly kind of manoeuvring along.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is a journey and a process that we continue to, or a road that we continue to move along, as you say. And lovely that you know your those experiences, both yourself and Michelle as well. That openness with the boys as well, and you know, for me, the level of transparency that we can share with others, children, our loved ones, is crucial, because often I think society presses upon us a way of being or a way of living, the things that we should and shouldn't do, but it takes away the organic nature of our existence, the realness, the genuineness, and children, being such intuitive creatures, we'll see right past it anyway. So we should always just, I mean, I would always urge people to just go with their intuition and go with their gut and be present with those emotions, because the more we try and lock those emotions down, the, you know, the more difficult they become in the long run.
Absolutely. And I think talking is vital, obviously.
Yes.
I think we've, like I say, as a family, we've always been very open and talked about, you know, our emotions. We, you know, all emotions, you know, whether it's just general day-to-day angst or if it's positive stuff, whatever it might be. I think, but talking and connecting, I think are just so vital for us as humans, as animals, to make sure that we can keep communicating our feelings and stuff. I think it's just something we've always done as a family, and probably something we didn't do as a family when I was younger, and possibly some of the, you know, some of that stuff's come out because we didn't talk and communicate about those things. Certainly my dad found it very difficult to communicate generally, and I think probably led to his own personal problems. So I think, yeah, I've seen it from both sides. So you can see that talking and communicating it works, and not communicating leads to a whole bunch of trouble. So yeah, I think from experience, it's always good to have that
ongoing communication.
And do you think society has changed? Do you think that that was quite generational for that period, lack of speaking?
Yeah, I think stiff upper lip and all that kind of stuff. I think my dad was that kind of generation. You just kind of, you know, man up, which is a horrible, horrible term. Get on. But clearly it doesn't work. You know, affected his life and led probably led to his, you know, premature death, that because he didn't communicate those feelings that he had. He used other means to hide them. So I think we are much better as a society. We are getting better. We're not there yet, particularly about grief. I mean, we're certainly not there yet. But I think, you know, with regards to sort of mental health, we're getting a lot better. I think there's a long way to go with regards to loss and grief, but we're making inroads, I think. But yeah, I think it does take, I think, you know, national loss, I think sometimes where we see big figures, I know like people sort of, I've seen it on social media sometimes, if a big, like a celebrity or a well-known figure passes away, and there's a sort of outpouring of grief around the loss of those people. And you do see or get sort of naysayers saying, oh, well, you don't know them, blah, 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 whatever it might be. You know, you don't know what they were like. But I think that's really important, actually, that we do that. If we're expressing ourselves as a society about loss, I think that really helps people who might be in a situation where they can't do that about their own situation. Mm. So I think I always think that's really great. I think that should always be take solace in that when I see people sort of with an outpouring of grief over whoever it might be. I think that's really important because I think that helps us all.
Mm. I would agree. I think that it's almost safer to connect with the emotions when it is, you know, let's say someone in the public eye that's passed. Obviously the individual that comes to mind more recently is the Caroline Flack situation.
Yeah,
and a big movement about kindness and being kind. And I think that what situations like that do, and albeit we're in a slightly different situation at the minute because of the pandemic and that, but I think where we currently are, what situations like that do is do hold up a bit of a mirror to society sometimes and say, look, mm-hmm. you know, this goes on and this is really challenging. And actually some of the emotions that we're all feeling as a result of this are okay. And I think you're right to point out to your point, you know, that it brings those more difficult emotions into sort of sharper focus. But people find it easier to then post on social media and say sort of we need to be doing this. And for me it's always been a case of, do you know what, this is lovely to see, in line with what you said, now let's carry that on. Can we keep doing it when the world begins to swallow us up again? Because I'm a believer that nobody's ever really broken. It's always the outside world that's the broken space, and it's how do we prevent too much of it flooding into our system and sort of corrupting that space. And you know, so how can we just maintain and preserve our existence without allowing too much to come in and demand too much of us and corrupt it, and just maintain some of that. And you made a wonderful post recently, I think it was this week actually, where you sort of said just about be kind and considerate and tolerant and patient. And what the bit that really stood out again was it was just be. Every single one started with B, and just in that moment, can we consider all of these qualities that are so crucial to nourish us, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I've put a few posts out like that. Just to, you know, and I guess, you know, I've been accused of being a bit pious sometimes, but it's not easy for everybody to do those things, and I understand that. But if we can at least reflect on one or two of them, maybe, you know, can we be patient, more patient with people? Can we be more tolerant? Can we be more compassionate? Can we be more empathetic? I think, can we be more kind? I mean, they're questions, really. Can we be these things? I think we probably all look at ourselves and think, yeah, I probably could be a bit more of that. And I could be a bit more of this. Can I reach out to people more? Yeah, probably could. You know, there's all those things that I think if we really sort of took the time to reflect, we probably could do a lot of those things better or do them more. And how much better would our lives be and the lives of the people we come into contact with if we all just took a little bit of time? Well, you didn't even take time, but just be a bit of those things a little bit more. I'm using the word be a lot as well. I think, you know, and a lot of these things, they're not hard to do. They should be kind of, should, but that's not the right word. But they feel like they are part of what makes us human. And how...
Well, they are.
Yeah.
They are. And I think we struggle... I think some struggle because they see it as almost a dichotomy, that it's one or the other.
Mm.
When quite rightly you're saying it's just a little bit of time, just a little bit of being kinder or compassionate. And, you know, because the world itself, it's not black and white. It's always going to be shades of grey. Mm. And if we can begin to... if we can begin to be more present, then I believe that we have an opportunity to display some of these qualities that we are all blessed with, that we can all display. But it's that time. And really, we are at this current moment, it has been a wonderful opportunity to explore some of these assets that we possess, these values that we can live by. And I think that if we can begin to adopt, we're talking atomic habitual changes. We're talking sort of small changes that potentially could have quite significant effects, primarily on our own well-being, on our own sense of self and value and happiness of our life, that then ripples or distributes out to the wider community and family and so on and so forth. So I think it's been great. Obviously you're very present on social media and some of these posts are fantastic. And I suppose what we should really come on to, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go to your first song choice. But when we come back on the subject of positivity and being kinder and more compassionate as well, we must talk about your new show that's coming out, A Little Bit of Positive, with the lovely Julia Bradbury.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah, right. Well, stick with us here on The Happiness Algorithm. I'm James Rose. My guest today is Giles Paley-Phillips. We're going to go to Giles' first song choice. We'll be back after this. Thank you.
Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm. That was Minus the Bear, Diamond Lightning. That was my guest, Giles Paley Phillips' first song choice. Giles, that was a great song.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm a massive fan of Minus the Bear. And that song, I just really love that. So I don't know, I don't ever get, it's one of those songs I never get bored of listening to. So much going on in it. And like lyrically, it's kind of, I think, sort of, kind of a bit trippy almost, like about a guy's just sort of a sort of summery kind of being with mates and messing around. I think that's what the lyrics are around. But I just, the coastline bridge stuff is sort of, reminds me of, I live on the coast, so it just reminds me of our coastline and just, yeah, sort of summer days with friends. So yeah, it's just a, I don't know, it's just, it sends shivers down my spine when I listen to it.
Yeah, good song, great song, and good times, you know, in terms of being able, and you know what, hey, some of those good times may come back. We might be able to spend some time at the coast and with a little bit more freedom. So, Giles, just before we took that break with your first song choice, we spoke a little bit about positivity and some of the stuff that's coming up for you is a new venture, a new podcast that's about to land, a little bit of positive with Julia Bradbury. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Julia and I have been friends for a little while on, well, mainly I think we've met through social media, but Julia came on Blank podcast about a year or so ago, and we really hit it off and we've just stayed in touch. And you know, she's a very positive, she's got a very positive outlook on life. She does, she's really into environmental issues, climate change stuff, and particularly around like promotion of green spaces and going out and enjoying wildlife and the outdoors, really. That's kind of her thing, is of like the love of the outdoors, and she obviously does lots of walking shows and she's written lots of books about walking. So we just had this sort of rapport about these things, and yeah, ages ago we said, oh, it'd be really good to work on a project together of some sort, you know, I don't know what it'd be, but something, you know, and a podcast, obviously everyone's doing podcasts at the moment, and so we kind of thought, well, we've got this thing in common that we're both very, you know, try and be very positive about life and the world. And we thought it was a really good sort of place to start with doing a show that would be sort of centered around kind of positive news, positive stories, and, you know, talking to sort of insightful guests about their own journeys and what positivity means to them. And so, yeah, so that's how it came together, really. And we thought it was probably the best time to do it now, while, you know, we're in a sort of bleaker time socially and as a country and as a world as well, actually. You know, this is a global thing that's going on at the moment. So I think it just felt like it was a good time to put something slightly more positive out in the world and hopefully give people a little respite from, you know, particularly, and now I've talked to loads of people in the last couple of weeks, just been sort of reaching out to people and seeing how they are, how much the news and social media are really getting to them. Because, you know, the world just seems so bleak and dark at the moment. We've obviously got the pandemic sort of rumbling on, you know, we've had lockdown, we're, you know, we've been in isolation, we've been away from our friends and family. And also, obviously, what's been happening post the George Floyd stuff and the Black Lives Matter movement. And, you know, I think people are angry and they're upset and you know, quite rightly. And so I think we just thought, let's give the world a little bit of respite from some of these harsher times that we're going through.
Yeah, and I think, it, like you say, it's an opportune moment and a good time to be sharing some of that positivity with, and we spoke about a little about this off air, that, you know, it's not, for me, there's a twofold or two-ply effect to it, that the reality of our existence is what it is, and you know, there's some really difficult, this is a very difficult time that we're living in at the minute. And if they're on top of that, if people are going through their own personal crisis as well, it becomes overwhelming and almost impossible to wade through. And I think what's lovely about a little bit of positive is it's not saying, you know, don't worry about all of that. You know, here's the positive stuff, focusing on that. It's creating the balance and adding texture to a situation and a time in our lives that could be, as I say, overwhelming or really turbulent, and saying, you know what, look, here's these little stories, these narratives that are forming that would be so easily lost in a world that seems to be struggling, but also in part preoccupied with negative.
Yeah.
It's just that little bit of light that you're sharing. And as you say, Julia is, she is a walking beacon of positivity as well. So it's lovely to see that you're both sharing that platform together.
Yeah, she's a real force of nature, actually. And it's funny, you know, she's like that in real life. She's just a bundle of energy, and she just got such a great, like I say, she's got a great energy about her, and she's a really lovely person to be around. And yeah, she exudes that, and you get that off her. So you start to feel good, and, you know, and I think that's all past you. She sort of injects oxytocin into you, so you feel like amazing. And I think that's, you know, and it is, yeah, I think we just wanted to do something that was a little bit different, because, you know, like you say, we're so wrapped up in negativity and drama that actually it would be nice to just put out some nicer stories and things that, like you say, people wouldn't necessarily see on their radar. So we're sort of scalping around trying to find positive stories wherever we can and share those. And then we've got guests on that, and you alluded to it there, just saying about the, you know, this isn't like a gushy, like everything's amazing. It's talking to, you know, people who've had difficult times and have come through it in a positive way or have had a positive outcome. You know, so it's not all, you know, it's not all like kind of slushy love and everything's great. We are sort of looking at sort of more difficult things, but, you know, seeing how sometimes we can overcome those things through a positive mindset or through being kind or compassionate, whatever it might be. And so we're sort of, that's what we're trying to do, really.
Yeah. And for me, it's the, I always find that, you know, you mentioned there about Julia being that force of positivity as well. And that when we're discussing good news stories, when we're sharing positivity as well, it will lift our spirit. And as I say, that two-ply effect is not dismissing what we're going through, but essentially it's the accommodation and the acceptance of, you know what, rubbish happens and life will be hard sometimes, and there is difficulties. That's the inevitable. There's the predictability there. But let's not get knocked off course or be consumed by it. And the more we can share and talk about, we go back to talking again, the importance of talking, going back to that positivity. I think it just warms everybody. It just warms everyone, because it gives us that little respite, that little form of escapism for that moment, that we can immerse ourselves into a world where there is goodness. And that tops us back up. And it sort of solidifies our defences a little bit more, ready to sort of attack the world another day for another, you know, another battle that we take on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think it's just nice to know there are other things going on. You know, there are positive things that people are taking, positive steps that people are taking in their lives, and that we can all, like we were saying earlier about the be stuff, like be patient, be tolerant, be compassionate. You know, often these are things that people are trying to do, and it's led to a positive outcome. So it's kind of sort of an extension of those sort of things that I've been trying to sort of put across on social media.
Excellent. Now we can't go through today's show without mentioning the picture books, the books that precede, came before 152 days. Obviously, your first book, which was we spoke about this before. So this was the book that you done with Liz Pichon.
Yeah.
D-
It's called Things You Never Knew About Dinosaurs.
There we go. Do you know what? The name totally fell out of my head. Right. And as we said off air before, it's sitting upstairs in my children's room, which has just been re-released again recently.
Yeah, so it's found a new home. It sometimes happens with books. They kind of get lost. I think the publishing company it was with went bust, so we got the rights reversed. So that means that, you know, Liz and I got the rights to the story back, and you know, we decided we wanted to put it out again in the world because we just didn't think it got a fair chance last time. So luckily Scholastic, who is Liz's brilliant publisher for her Tom Gates books, which are amazing, I recommend them to anybody, decided they'd like to put it out. So yeah, it's found a new lease of life, which is lovely. So it's been given us lovely spanking new cover, and yeah, it looks really, really good, and I'm really pleased to see it back out in the world because I was very proud of it. It's the first book I ever wrote, basically. So back in the day when I decided I wanted to write, I think it was after the birth of our first son Elijah, I decided I wanted to, I just sort of become a bit obsessed with wanting to write a story for him. And there was one day I was really struggling. I was working at a toy shop at the time, and my lunch break, I was sort of just going through various like charity shops and stuff, trying to find sort of inspiration, looking in through the picture books and children's books, and just trying to find something. And one day I came across this book called A Light in the Attic by an American author called Shel Silverstein. And not a lot of people have heard of him in the UK, but he sort of does nonsense poetry. And in America, though, he's like Roald Dahl. He's huge. He's written lyrics for Johnny Cash and all sorts of things. And he does these little funny little pictures with these nonsense poetry. And I remember started reading some of them, and I just thought it was like a eureka moment. This is like, this is what I want to do. This is exactly what I want to do. This is, you know, and I just suddenly started getting loads and loads of ideas, and I literally ran back to work, and on some post-it notes and old bits of receipts and stuff, I wrote this book, Things You Never Knew About Dinosaurs. So yeah, it's kind of a weird that was the start of my writing career, basically.
I love that story. It's those pivotal moments, those opportunities that we take, those chance meetings that we stumble across stuff, and for me, there's a lot of courage and bravery that goes with that, and it would be great for many more people to sort of run with that. Sometimes we go back, as you said before, about intuition and just going with it. I was going to ask about children's books and why it's important to you to produce these books. I'll stop that question there and go with that. What is it? What does it provide you? What is it about writing for children that's so important?
Well, I think it was probably at the beginning, it was a very selfish kind of thing, just wanting to write a story for my child, or something that I think I had this sort of vision in my head of sitting with him, you know, at bedtime. And I talk about this a lot with people, is that how vital bedtime stories are. Because I think they give you and your child an opportunity to talk.
I couldn't agree more.
And also sort of really look at, you know, you can talk about and going on from that, storytelling as well is a way of being able to address certain subjects. So I think, you know, obviously children's books do that to a certain extent. I've tried to write books as well that address certain subjects that you can, because it's a safe environment of that bedtime story, and you are able to talk about their day, how they're doing. You know, you can go off and talk about various different things and also address subjects in the books with them that will help them going forward. You know, I think children's books are vital for that. So it's always been a really important thing for me in that respect. But as I say, at the beginning, it was more that kind of, I guess, that dream of having, you know, when you've have your first children, it's that those moments that you're thinking like cuddling up on the sofa watching a movie, or having a bedtime story with them, eating meals with them, those sort of things are little kind of dreams you have at the beginning when they're first born. It's just those sort of ideals that you have, and that was one of them, I think. And I think that's why I probably became a bit obsessed with trying to do it, because I wanted to be able to read my story to him, or his story actually, really, because it was a story for him. So to be able to read a story that was specifically for him, to him, was like a kind of, yeah, it was a lovely sort of thing. But then I got a bit carried away and wrote loads more.
So that was obviously your oldest son Elijah. He's aware that this is where it all began. It was that legacy and wanting to write for him.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and obviously, yeah, and twofold, like for his brother as well. You know, like obviously, subsequent books have been kind of written specifically for him. You know, Sonny, who's our little one, he's inspired books I've written. So, you know, they've both been. I guess they've both been a big inspiration for me wanting to do it and to continue to do it. But yeah, I think that,
yeah,
just the idea that people, I mean, I wrote a book called Little Bell and the Moon, which is all about loss, actually. It sort of follows the journey of a little girl as she sort of goes on nighttime journeys, discovers the world with the moon. And then it's a sort of life cycle. So it's seeing her through her life until eventually at the end of the book, she passes away. But then she becomes, it's the idea that we become stardust, you know, and so she becomes stardust in the star sky and is with the moon, and that this is kind of a love story between her and the moon. And but it was like tackling that idea of loss, and that was really important to me, because obviously I've said in the earlier parts of the show that we've always been very open and honest with the children, and I thought that if I could allow other parents to have that moment with their children in that safe environment of the bedtime story, they can address subjects like loss or grief in an environment which is, you know, which is safe for them, and how they, you know, they can address these things in a nice way, in a comfortable way. I think that's part of what's made me want to continue doing these kind of books, because I just think it's those moments in with our children are just very special. And I mean, it makes me quite emotional actually thinking about it, but just being able to convey through stories difficult things, I think is, yeah, I don't really have the words really. It's just very important to me.
Well, I think the words that you are using and you know, it's evident that the emotion that is felt. It's ditto. I think that those closing down the day activities are easily lost moments, and sharing those with our children or sharing those with loved ones are crucial, because it's a period of the day where the intensity of the world lessens considerably, and it's almost a sacred space where quite rightly we have an opportunity to discuss or share or connect with things that can be difficult. It also provides an opportunity to share that children to share anything that they're going through as well. And I think the way that you are enabling families to do that is truly incredible. And I think that, you know, the work you do and the books that you've produced and are just perfect for that, for children to and parents to dip into that and share that space is great. Because I think sometimes the opportunity for me and we said again off air that, you know, it's funny that so many of your books are upstairs in the children's rooms that we've read over the years, and being able to see the world in a simpler form through a child's eyes is an incredibly rewarding and enriching process. And I think the more people can do it, the better we can be again as a society.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm very lucky. I get to go to do lots of, I mean, in normal times, I do a lot of school visits and stuff, and just, I do a few workshops and creative writing workshops and stuff within schools, and getting, just hearing children's ideas on the world and their thoughts and stuff is just brilliant, you know, and obviously get that through my own children as well. So yeah, I think it's vital for us as adults to remain in, you know, and I think that possibly why I continue to write those kind of books. I want to, you know, it's cliche, but the big kid at heart thing, but it's nice to stay in that world a little bit sometimes, that sort of, you know, the innocence of it and stuff is just great. And Yeah, it's why I continued kind of writing those books, I think.
Yeah, well, we can forget, can't we? I think that that's the one thing that the world does to us. It almost conditions us to leave a lot of that behind. But there's, as I say, there's so much that we can take from it and dipping back into that world as frequently as we can is always going to be, I'm always going to advocate that in some way. Yeah. So Giles, let's go to your second song choice, if we may. So stick with us here on the Happiness Algorithm. My guest today is Giles Paley Phillips. This is his second song choice. We'll be back after this.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never. I never wanted water once. Never, never, never. I listen to my words, but they fall far below. I let my music take me where my heart wants to go. I swam upon the devil's lake, but never, 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 I'll never make the same mistake. No, never, never, never.
Phoenix FM.
Welcome back to the Happiness Algorithm with me, James Roast. That was Cat Stevens, The Wind. That was my guest, Giles Paley Phillips, second song choice. A beautiful song there, Giles.
Yeah, it's only like 2 minutes long or something. It's really short. But yeah, I love that song. I think there's a couple of reasons why I love it. I think there's a lyric in it called I Let My Music Take Me Where My Heart Wants to Go. And I think that's about, you know, sort of, As a younger man, music was such a big part of my life, and you know, I kind of dropped out of education because I wanted to pursue music, and so I think it's always been like basically about following your passions, and that idea has kind of carried on with me. I've been a bit impetuous when it comes to, if I have an idea of something, I kind of go for it, and sort of, yeah, from a creative point of view, I've always tried to follow my heart a little bit, and then also. My hometown, a bit like the first song, I live on the coast in Sussex, and it's incredibly windy here. So listening to that song, it just reminds me of home, the wind, you know. And I think I've never wanted to leave this place. I've lived here all my life. It's very special to me. And again, going back to that idea of like following your heart with creativity, I have followed my heart with creativity, but I've never wanted to leave this little town, so I've probably missed opportunities creatively because I've wanted to stay here, but I think, you know, so it's one of those weird juxtapositions, but yeah, that song, yeah, I've always loved that song. It's just very sweet little sort of ditty, and I'm a big fan of Cat Stevens. He's slightly underrated, I think.
Yeah, great lyricist. Phenomenal. The way he pulls it together. So the following one's heart, that must be an intrinsic or important part of what you, well, one of your values, what you stand for, and do you endorse that for others?
Yeah, oh, big time. Yeah, when people, yeah, I get a lot of people contact me about asking for writing advice and all that kind of stuff, and people sometimes get a bit too precise, too precision about things, and follow a certain logical path with things. And I just think sometimes you just have to go, you said it earlier, with your gut, your instincts. I remember reading this or listening to some guy talking about, he'd spent time with an Aborigine tribe, and they literally make all their decisions in the tribe with their gut instincts. So because they feel that, unfortunately, their guts are the best thing in kind of making decisions. They make all their decisions through their guts, whereas they feel like sometimes things get filtered through our hearts and our heads. So, you know, and that's so true that, you know, sometimes we get an instinct for something, a feeling for something, and then we kind of let our hearts kind of have a go at it. And then we sort of, you know, we think, oh, am I sure about this? You get emotional about it, and then you start to let your brain get involved, and then you start to think more logically about it and how this will impact me and all that kind of stuff. And then you end up not doing the thing in the first place or not following that first instinct. And I think it's really important to I mean, this is slightly going away from the idea of following your heart, but I think my instincts on things or feelings on things are normally there, and I think from the beginning, and I try and hold on as long as possible to those bits of it, of an idea, or, you know, whatever's coming up, that feeling, you know, everything I've kind of pursued, I know that it started as a feeling and a desire and wanting to do that, and not really letting my brain get involved too much at all. And I think I try and sort of say that to other people, is just if you've got a feeling for something you want to do, you know, you've got to feel a passion for something, then just go for it and don't think too hard about it, because you'll either end up putting it off, not doing it, or you'll analyze it so much that it won't be the thing that you really wanted it to be.
Yeah, we can always find a million reasons not to do something, can't we? Yeah. When that fear or doubt begins to creep in.
Absolutely,
Like the toy shop, you could have quite easily just gone back and not engaged with that sort of optimum flow state and, you know, jotted down that story on post-it notes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's been so many, I've had so many moments like that in my life. And like I say, it's normally because there was an instinct or a feeling to do the thing that probably wasn't was probably the easier thing to do. You know, I've always tried to be a bit braver. Brave is not the right word, but yeah, just to dive into stuff sometimes. And that's not always been the best thing, but generally speaking, I can say I am where I am now because I let my heart rule my head.
Well, I'm gonna say it is bravery. You're a very modest guy, and as you said, but I'm gonna say it is bravery, because I said at the top of the show that, you know, 152 days is written in a very courageous way, because, you know, as we said all along, that the emotions that for me that was elicited through 152 days, but equally, like we've said with some of the children's picture books as well, the emotions that can be discussed are often seen as difficult or complex emotions. And so to be able to tackle those and to be able to provide an opportunity for people to explore those emotions in a safe way, I think is very brave. And very courageous. And I think if you hadn't have taken these brave steps or run back to the toy shop or some of those opportune moments like you've had, we wouldn't be having this wonderful conversation now, and we wouldn't be able to, none of us would be able to immerse ourselves in the wonderful writing that you've done over the years and produced and shared with us and created probably some very memorable and happy moments for so many families.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. I'll like I said to you earlier, I'm trying to take these compliments.
Hopefully you're not squirming too much in your seat, because genuinely mean it.
Well, no, I really appreciate it, James. That's very kind. Yeah, well, I hope so. I hope so. And again, you know, just I guess going back to what we were just saying, it there are rewards to be had for you and others if you can be a bit more. If you can let your heart rule your head sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Giles, what does the next 6, 12, 18, 24 months look like? What in the world of Giles, what are you hoping for? Where's your gut going to take you?
I think the next, well, I've had this conversation with my wife and quite a few people actually recently about where my head dwells. I've done a lot of past, I've been a dweller in the past quite a lot of my life, hence why I've written like 150 days. And I've tried the sort of future dwelling aspect of living, like looking to the future and seeing what's going to be around the corner. But I don't feel very comfortable there. So I'm very much, I would say, a present dweller. I kind of take days as they come. I don't like to try and look too far ahead of things. Also, being a freelancer is a very perilous journey. And you never know what work's going to come in or what's not going to come in, what ideas are going to come or not come. So I think I'm in a really good place at the moment. I've got a few little projects on the go that are really exciting and enjoyable to do. Podcasts in particular, I really love doing those. Doing things like this, talking to people like you, is, I love it. Got a few book ideas, but nothing kind of set in stone. I'm just kind of taking each day as it comes, and I feel more comfortable when I'm dwelling in the present and just being present as well. I think if you, for me, if I look too much or too far ahead, I get confused and I get a little bit anxious. And I can't tell you particularly why that is, but I think, I just think that if I'm in the present, if I'm dwelling in the present and just being me now, then I think I can be the best me. Whereas I think if I'm trying to think too much about what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day or 6 months or 12 months from now, then I will just be thinking about that more and not being where I am now and not enjoying what I'm doing now. I think I'll be always thinking about the next thing. And I think it's really important to not do that. Try and enjoy what you're doing. It's the journey. I've had this conversation with a few people as well, that how important the journey is and how that's the enjoyable part, and that thinking about what's at the end of the journey, it's just not good. It's not good for you. So I'm trying to do that a lot more. Just enjoy the journey, enjoy each day as it comes, be present for family and friends and whoever. And in answer to your question, I don't know. And in some respects, I don't care.
Oh, I love that.
Because, you know, if I worried about too much, if I think, oh, I'm going to do this, that and the other, I probably won't end up doing those things. And then I would have set myself all these targets and goals that I'm not, you know, that I might not achieve. And so I think it's better if I don't do that. For me personally. So I'm sorry to say that to you, but no, I don't care what I'm doing in 12 or 24 months time. Hopefully I'm doing some interesting stuff. And that's all I can do is hope that, you know, and hope is a brilliant thing. And so hopefully I'm doing some brilliant stuff, but I'm doing some brilliant stuff at the moment. And I'm trying to enjoy that stuff as much as possible.
Well, you know what? I think that that's a perfect answer to the question, because the presence of mind or you know, the focus on the journey as opposed to the end goal is something that I'll often promote. And there's a wonderful child, I think she's a child psychologist, Carol Dweck, and she said,
oh, yeah, that, growth mindset.
You know, that, yes, yeah. And it's all about, you know, children's journey is about, children's development is about praising the journey and not the end goal. Because I think, again, we go back to the conditioning effect that society can often have on us. And almost from a schooling system as well, we board that train at 5 years old and we exit it at some point. So we're sort of driven and herded into this way of thinking. And I mentioned it on last week's show as well. I'll have to paraphrase. I'll do it a disservice. But a wonderful Buddhist saying that says that we, if we're anxious, we're living in the future. If we're depressed, we're living in the past. We've got no jurisdiction or control over either. But we have over the present, this present moment. And so being present and being happy, content and hopeful. I mean, this is where we all should be, isn't it? Surely.
It's hard to do though, because I know my wife does it a bit, and we've had conversations about it. She's a planner. She likes to plan. She wants to know what she's doing next week, the week, you know, she's a planner, and it's good. And that's probably, it works well for us because I can reel her in a bit. She can make me feel a bit more like, pragmatic about stuff. So that's good. You know, so it balances out well, but I think, yeah, I think a lot of people I know that are anxious I've suffered from anxiety for many years, and I think it's helped me to not think too far ahead. And I think a lot of people that I know that suffer from anxiety are constantly worrying about what's going to happen, what's going to be going on next week, what's going to happen tomorrow, you know. And I think, yeah, like you said, that great saying, you can't do anything about that. So it's kind of best not to go there.
Yeah. And it's always going to be a plague of our existence, the fact that we're going to always fear the unknown. And, you know, a lot of the children that I work with that you know, going through that difficult developmental phase of the world, you know, being black and white in early years, and more often than not it is from an atypical family, but as they go through that transitional development into early adulthood or adolescence, the world moves from being black and white to shades of grey, never to make sense again, really. So the art, and it is an art more than a science, the art of being an adult is learning to tolerate that discomfort, and the biggest discomfort being the unpredictability of our existence. And if we're always lost or always leaving ourselves in the future, that will end up exacerbating or elevating levels of anxiety for us, which is never going to be, it's never going to be good, is it, for, you know, long term. And so bringing ourselves back into that present, I would definitely back. So for the listeners of the Happiness Algorithm, Giles, that would be what you would recommend, you know, looking at being present, trusting in your gut instinct, feelings.
Yeah, both those things, tenfold. Yeah, brilliant. Follow your heart, listen to your gut, and stay present as much as possible. And I know it's difficult. It's difficult for people. We are, you know, and as a society, it's drummed into us. What's your pension going to be when you're older? Have you got your life insurance? You know, is your mortgage paid? There's all these constraints, and I totally understand that. And it's not easy. It's, you know, but if we can all just take some, and this is going back again, just give ourselves some time and space now and again, just to be present and focus on what we have and what we've got now, I think our lives will be so much nicer and easier.
Yeah, well said. And I think, it, as you say, to add, it's that patience and practice of doing that, because it isn't easy, like you say, but we can enrich our lives by bringing it back, grounding ourselves back to sort of that center, anchoring ourselves to that moment. People will already be following you, but those that want to see what you're up to and keep up to speed with the new podcasts and episodes of Blank that are coming out and new projects that are on the horizon, share your handles, websites, and all of those bits and bobs.
Yeah, well, you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Eli Is Tender, which is ELISTENDER 1010. So yeah, Eli's Tender 10. You can find me on Twitter. I'm mainly on Twitter. I'm sometimes on Instagram, occasionally on Facebook. That seems to be the way we're all going, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Facebook's like for grandparents now. I mean, it's only like, you know, I mean, it's in its infancy as a company. It's only like 12 years old or something, but it's already just bypassed into saga kind of era. As regards to social media platforms. But yeah, Twitter and Instagram are kind of my things. I don't bother with Snapchat, that's for young people. So yeah, so you can find me on those. And yeah, it's Blank Podcast with Giles Paley Phillips and Jim Daly. And yeah, the new podcast is A Little Bit of Positive with Julia Bradbury and myself, Giles Paley Phillips. And yeah, you can find those all on all podcast platforms. And if you want to buy my books, you can get them in all the usual places, really. The best person to get them from, if I can recommend someone, is on Twitter at Green Bookshop. The Big Green Bookshop. A lovely guy that runs the Big Green Bookshop from his, I think he's doing it from his home at the moment, down in Hastings. But he will get you any books that you need, not just my books. So yeah, I'd hugely recommend the Big Green Bookshop.
And that's at Big Green Bookshops on Twitter, on the social media.
I think he's on Facebook as well. But yeah, I highly recommend if you want to get a book and help a very small independent trader, then yeah, please, because he's really good.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, the independent traders of the world, it's nice that they're still there and not being sort of consumed by the mass monsters. Not knocking the mass monsters, hey, no, you know, no. But lovely. Yeah, so that's at Big Green Bookshops. Obviously, you've heard Giles, all his social media handles there as well. Giles, it's been, as I said at the beginning of the show, I was so excited to have you on, and it has lived. It's gone beyond actually what I expected today. Well, it's true, and as I say, I think that, you know, I said to you off air, I'm so grateful for you coming on as well, and giving your time to the Happiness Algorithm. We could have spoke on and on and on and on hours.
Yeah, I've loved it, Joe. Thank you for having me on. I've really appreciated it. And yeah, I probably garbled quite a lot, but please, thank you for giving me the platform to talk.
Well, no, I think, you know, look, it's been a really wonderful conversation. I think for me, what I'll be taking from it is bravery. We can all be a little bit braver, following our gut, following our instincts, following our heart, being more courageous. Don't look too far ahead, you know, live in the moment, you know, look at the valuable relationships that we have at our immediacy, that we've got on our doorstep, and be present with those, and really reconnecting. And again, this is personally me speaking in terms of my children as well. It's that those special moments at the end of the day, and reading and sharing a story and providing that opportunity to connect in a world that is often demanding and asking so much of us. And so I'll be bringing that in over this week, certainly, and looking to continue that on. Again, I've said throughout the show, but for the listeners, I do urge you to go out and read 152 Days, a fantastic emotional journey, and written just amazingly well at conveying this that period. But on all shows, we do have to hand over to Mr. Hanks to see what he thought of the show. So, Mr. Hanks, how did you think that went?
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you very much. I would agree with that too. So, Giles, my guest today has been Giles Paley Phillips. Thank you so much. I've been James Rose. This has been the Happiness Algorithm. Be safe. Be well. Until next week, be happy.
Trees are singing along with me. I'm just looking for happy. Sunrise lights my smiley face clock, sliding in my socks. I pour my first cup of tea. I'm just looking for happy.
chair, pages where wizards and knights have magical fights as the rain taps so tepidly. I'm just looking for happy. Shoulder, drinking the moment the sun falls into the sea. I'm just looking for happy. Yeah, I'm just looking for happy.
Phoenix FM.